In the previous section of Revelation, Revelation 21, John described the new creation, a new solar system and a new renewed planet Earth. Revelation 21, verses 1 through 8. Revelation 21, verses 9 through 27 are the zoomed-in version of the new Earth, focusing in on a somewhat large city called the New Jerusalem that John describes in great length. And in that section of Revelation 21, John focuses on the appearance of the construction and the engineering, the design, the appearance, the shape, the size, the construction of this city. But now in Revelation 22, verses 1 through 5, we have John's last vision of the entire book of Revelation. One final look at the heavenly realm, or the future end times. And here he zooms in even closer with the help of an angel onto the center of the New Jerusalem. The living conditions, the natural features that are there. John's previous explanations have shown correlations between this future city of the New Jerusalem and the past and today for us present Jerusalem of history. He shows connections and correlations between these two cities. And now in the next section that we're looking at tonight, he will show correlations to something that even predates the city of Jerusalem. Something that brings the panorama of God's plan for the world and humanity to a full circle, the Garden of Eden. By highlighting these correlations, John underscores God's purpose for the new creation as not just being something new, but something that is renewed. It's something that is brought back, restored, returned to its original condition, but so much better. Sin had corrupted this new world, including the Garden of Eden. But now God brings it all back again, better than before, completing the circle, that stage, that platform where sin crept into the world and mankind fell into separation from God and the lights turned out. On this stage, the lights turn on again, brighter than ever before. Let's see what John saw and savor what he sees in the center of this new Jerusalem city. In verse 1, John says, "And he showed me," which is a reference to the angel of Revelation 22, or 21 and verse 9. This is one of the seven angels that poured out one of the bowls of God's wrath that invited John to a high overlook, a mountain type location, to look down on the New Jerusalem from above. The same angel is now inviting him to look into the center of the city and to see what's there. What's on the town square of the city, essentially? What's happening at City Hall in New Jerusalem? Well, when you go down to most city centers in America, what you don't find is a beautiful garden. If you want to go to a large botanical garden, the botanical gardens of any city are not usually downtown. It's hard to get a beautiful garden to flourish downtown. I mean, I guess there's one in Brooklyn, but that's even kind of a little bit out of the way. And it's all walled off and protected from everything else that's going on around there, or it would be more like Central Park than a botanical garden. But what's amazing about this city is at the center of this city is essentially a garden. John says that the angel showed me a pure river of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb in the middle of its street. Now, the idea here, a couple of things to point out. Now, this is our first allusion back to the Garden of Eden here in this section. This river. To visualize what John saw, it's probably best to take, some translations have in the middle of the street at the beginning of verse 2, but it's probably better to put it at the end of verse 1. Remember, there was no punctuation when the New Testament was written, and you have to kind of guess at some of the ways the sentences break down. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb in the middle of its street. The idea here is that this river is proceeding from the center of this city right down the middle of the main thoroughfare. Essentially, what you have here is a massive highway, from what I can tell, that runs from the gates of the city right down to the center of the city, a major thoroughfare all the way to the city square where God is, where the light burns the brightest. And from that place, John said he saw a river splitting the street, going right down the middle. I don't know, maybe one lane of traffic going in is on one side of the river and the other lane of traffic coming out is on the other side. Maybe it's like that. But that's the idea, a major street running to the city square with this river splitting down the middle. Now, the river, the New King James says, I saw the river proceeding from the throne. And so we envision in our minds this nice kind of serene, placid water with no ripples or anything in it, just kind of slowly floating out quietly and serenely from the throne. But probably really what's going on here is it's not proceeding, it's gushing and flowing from the throne. That's how rivers are, right? Flowing out, pouring out, gushing out from the throne. The water of life, not in a trickle, but in a surge. An everlasting fountain of the water of life that doesn't make pools and puddles and streams, but a river coming from the throne of God. This captivating scene, this water is clear, John said, and translucent, free from anything that would contaminate it or pollute it. You name for me one city in the world that could have a river come out from the center of that city and it would be pure. I used to live in Milwaukee, and they would send us in our mail every year from the city public works office a fold-out color diagram of what they do to the water to ensure that it is safe to drink. And then they would then explain to us what, if I recall correctly, was something like a 16-step purification process. And I would think to myself, well, what kind of water am I drinking if it needs a 16-step purification process? It needed to be processed like that because the water that it was coming from was Lake Michigan, and it had all kinds of stuff in that lake that they had to filter out. This city, from the city square, is going to come a river, and it's going to be so pure there isn't anything in it that would ever contaminate anything. Pure and clear. It pours out, flows out, and it provides spiritually refreshing, life-sustaining qualities. We know today that water sustains life, but this water will be more life-sustaining than the water we have today. It'll be more potent, more productive, and even have, from what we can tell, not just physical effects, but spiritual effects, whole person life. Somehow or another. Imagine going to the store and buying a beverage and picking up your favorite drink, and on the outside it says it gives protein, it gives energy, it gives you late night energy, and it gives you a special kick, and it gives you spiritual life. Spiritual life? Wow, I have to drink some of this and increase my Zen. That's how some of these drinks are advertised. It's almost as though it takes you to the next level as a human being. This water does that. This water has a spiritual effect of some kind on us that is more than what physical water alone can do. It comes from the throne of God. So many drinks today, you get water, right? And it shows a picture of this water coming from some spring in Colorado in the Rockies. You think, oh, I'm going to drink this water because it came from a pure spring somewhere out there, a geyser out in Colorado. And then you turn around and it says, made in Newark, New Jersey. Where would you get water in Newark, New Jersey that I would drink? So this water is literally coming from the purest possible source, the very throne and presence of God. This river reminds us of the river that flowed out from the Garden of Eden. Take a look at Genesis chapter 2 and verse 10. Genesis 2 and verse 10 goes out of its way to tell us, "Now a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it parted and became four river heads." And you can look at Genesis 2, 11 to 14, the following verses, to describe these four branches of the river went then into all these different regions of the world and was the way that the world was irrigated, watered. Then in Genesis 13, 10, if you look that up, you can see this description of Eden being that the water of its rivers would go out into the world and water the regions all around. When we read about this river of life coming from the throne of God and the New Jerusalem, we should also understand it as being the source of water for the new creation. The tree of life will flourish on both sides of the river. That's the next thing that John notices. On either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. This is our second allusion to the Garden of Eden, the tree of life. He observed a certain kind of tree growing on the banks of this river, the tree of life. Now, if you're thinking you're thinking to yourself what we often think. We're visualizing this throne. We're visualizing this nice, pristine, smooth kind of river, but it's not flowing. Just kind of sitting there really quietly and peaceful, like shining really nice. And then we're imagining this nice trunk of a tree sitting right here with these branches coming out with 12 different kinds of fruits hanging off of it. And you're thinking to yourself, well, how on earth, the new earth, will all of God's people from all eternity eat from this tree? It's going to be a long line. I guess we have eternity, and that's our explanation for everything, right, in the eternal state. So how does this work? I think what we need to do is correct this picture that artists have painted in our minds, because it's probably not accurate. I've already corrected the river part of this description. But the other thing we need to keep in mind is that this isn't a single tree, because how do you have a single tree on both banks of a river? And this is a very big river. It's not a little trickle of a stream. This is probably more of a Mississippi River type situation going on. Very big, maybe even bigger than that, because the New Jerusalem is pretty big. And I would venture to say that the throne of God is pretty impressive too. probably a very large spectacle of a river, and lining the banks of this river in between the major thoroughfare is what is the tree of life, a kind of tree on both banks of the river. And probably not just, doesn't have to be just kind of a single row of trees kind of planted methodically. Could simply be a forest of trees on both sides. It could be that big, lining the entire thoroughfare with the river in the middle. A river like that is going to be able to sustain a lot of trees of life. The idea is abundant variety here of the tree of life, the kind, the species of tree is the tree of life, and it has 12 different kinds of fruit. It could bear 12 different kinds of fruit all at once in monthly cycles. It could each tree bear a different kind of fruit per month, or some other variety of these kind of things. But what we do know is that every month they produce a new batch of fruit, and there are 12 different kinds of fruit that grow on the tree of life species. That's what's being described here. So John tells us this is what he saw, and we need to envision this kind of tree, but a lot of them lining this tree, this river. John doesn't necessarily say anything about eating the fruit, but we do know in the book of Genesis, in verse 9, that eating the fruit of the tree of life would enable you to live forever. We may need to also correct a slight misconception here as well, and that is, it's probably not true, it's possible, but probably less likely, that if you eat one piece of fruit from the tree of life, instant eternal life. One bite, you're in. It's probably not like that. It's probably more like how fruit works today. You take a bite, and the more you eat of it, the more it sustains you. In fact, it's possible Adam and Eve actually ate from the tree of life before they sinned. Have you ever wondered, how did they avoid the tree of life so long? It's possible they ate from it. But because they had sinned, God had to remove them from the garden quickly so they wouldn't have access to it anymore. My personal theory is going to be that may be one of the reasons why they maybe lasted a little longer than other people. I don't know. But that continued access gives continued value that enables you to keep on living longer is the idea. So God had to stop that. No more access. But in the new creation, because there is no longer any sin, we have unlimited access to eat from the tree of life however and whenever and wherever we want, because there will be no possible bad effects. Since God's people in the new creation are delivered from sin, we will have unrestricted access once again to the tree of life and abundance. John also highlights a second benefit of this tree, that its leaves will be for the healing of the nations. And I don't know exactly what these leaves are like. My mind envisions the aloe vera plant, the kind of plant that you can crack open and there's stuff that comes out of it, whatever it's called, and you can rub it on your scratches. My mom used to do that when I was a kid. I'd get a scratch, and she'd take a leaf off of a aloe vera plant, and she'd rub the little jelly stuff on my arm, and it would get better, I guess. So the idea here is that the leaves themselves will also have a healing power. And you might ask the question, why do I need to be healed in the new creation when there's no death, sickness, or disease? Of what would I need to be healed? You could ask a similar question, why would I need to eat the tree of life when I have eternal life? We're not entirely sure what this healing is all about, but we do know that eating it is better than not. I'd rather have the effects of these leaves and have the benefits of these fruits than not. One way of looking at this, I think, that's helpful is that both the water of life and the tree of life are central features and experiences to enjoy in the new creation. They'll provide physical and spiritual nourishment for us, a higher quality of life. We will not be able to die, contract disease, and get sick. We know that. But we will still be human beings, dependent upon God's provision for our life and our quality of life. We will not be gods, though we will be glorified and sanctified and all of these things and have eternal life. We will still be human beings who are dependent upon God's provision. And he's providing for us these things to maintain optimal health in eternity. God's presence, John goes on to describe, will replace the curse. This is a third allusion to the Garden of Eden, only it brings back bad memories. There's good memories in life, and then there's bad memories, right? I had good memories as a kid, but then there was that one night that I spent the night at my friend's house, and we watched horror movies. And we decided that whoever fell asleep first would have something done to them. That was not me. I didn't do those kind of things. But that one night, I was at this sleepover, and we did those kind of things one night. And I had a very guilty conscience about this. But the person who fell asleep first, we were playing Godzilla and King Kong on the old Nintendo. And we were watching old Frankenstein movies. And we're watching these things, playing these games. And the person who fell asleep first was Nathan. Nathan was the boy who had the birthday and invited us to his house. But we had to be men of our word in sixth grade, so we had to do something. And so as he laid there, one of the guys took my toothpaste tube and put toothpaste on his hand. And he slapped his face and rolled to the other side. He put toothpaste on his other hand. Did the same thing. If you're a kid listening to this, do not ever do this. He woke up the next morning with dried, hardened toothpaste all over himself, and he was not happy. I don't know if he invited us back to his house again. I don't remember that. But I was scared to go home. I was hoping my mom would not find out what I did. And I pretended like we had a great time. Everything was fine. What are we doing today? One of those days. This allusion to the Garden of Eden is one of those days. There wasn't anything really bad in the Garden of Eden. It was a beautiful experience. Except for the day that Satan came in and tempted Adam and Eve to sin, and they did. But here's the good news. The curse that came in Genesis 2 and 3 is gone in Revelation 22. John says there's no curse. That sad and tragic memory is replaced by something else, because sin is essentially the result. The curse is the result of sin and is essentially what happens when God removes his presence. When God removes his presence, there's separation. That's what death is, separation from God. When God removes himself from his creation, creation falls apart. When he removes himself from mankind, mankind goes his own way. The separation. But what John notes here is that there will be no more curse in the new creation, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it. How is this curse removed? It's replaced by the presence of God. God the Father places his throne in the center of the city. In the middle of the garden, he places his throne, and he rules and reigns from there. And also, the Lamb is also with him. In the Garden of Eden, the Lamb was nothing more to us than a very veiled and vague promise of a seed of a woman and a seed of a serpent stepping on each other. But now, the Lamb is there, victorious through his suffering. I don't imagine that Satan would be successful at slithering into this garden. Finally, John points out that in this place, we will, God's people, serve God as he created us to do. More allusions back to the Garden of Eden. Notice what he says here. They will serve him. Verse 4, and in verse 5, they will reign with him. Genesis 2:15 tells us that God placed man into the garden to tend it and to care for it. He put man in the garden to serve him, to take care of his creation. And that's what we will do in the new creation. And we won't mess up. He also says in Genesis 1:28 that man is to subdue the earth and to have dominion over it, which means you're going to control, to manage, to govern, and to reign over my creation as my vice regents, as my delegated rulers, leaders, and guides. To care and to govern God's creation, to bring out all of its potential for the glory of God, to explore and to expose all that is there more fully and completely, to discover and to proclaim what is there, and to do something with it for God's glory. This future experience of serving and reigning will be a complete and comprehensive reversal of what collapsed in the beginning. We get to go back and do it again and do it right this time. All of God's people will behave this way. Instead of two people failing, probably millions and billions of people will succeed. Forever. That's a beautiful thing. We will no longer rebel against God and exalt ourselves. We will all carry out his will forever and ever. John highlights three details about God's people as they serve him. First of all, we will see God's face, which is an anthropomorphism, which means it's a way of describing God with human terms. God is a spirit and does not have a face like a human being has a face, though we do know that the Lamb, Jesus Christ, will have a human face. We do know that. But this essentially means that we will see God in a most personal, intimate, and up-close way as possible. There will be nothing in between, nothing in the way. We will be face to face, quote unquote, with God at the center of the New Jerusalem. We will also have his name on our foreheads, which is a mark that indicates ownership. As a slave belongs to a master with a mark placed on the head is the idea. Will we actually have a mark tattooed or emblazoned onto our forehead? Will we actually have a kind of a spiritual mark, invisible but seen by spiritual glorified people? Or will it be something, and this often is the case as well, some kind of a hat or a crown or something with a mark on it? The answer is we don't know what this mark is going to be actually, but we know what these marks are intended to do, and that is show ownership. Ownership by God. I belong to God. I am His. He is my authority over me. But also, because He has marked me as His, He is obligated to secure, to provide, and to care for me. These marks have already been mentioned in Revelation 7:3 and 14:1 as being something given in the tribulation to the 144,000 Jewish witnesses. From them, we know that wearing a mark like this on this earth in this time is a good way to get yourself in trouble. But in the new heaven and the new earth, it has the opposite effect, because it will be His kingdom. Also, John notes again, he's pretty impressed by this. He's already mentioned it once, but he mentions it again. They're not going to need any lamps. He's very fascinated by this in the New Jerusalem because, well, like I already said, God Himself is going to be all the light that they need. The glory from His concentrated presence is going to be so brilliant that it will illuminate every place in the New Jerusalem. He also says there'll be no need for moon or sunlight as well in that place, and there won't be any nighttime either. And sometimes I've been disappointed by that because I kind of hope that maybe I'll feel differently then. Maybe I will. Maybe my glorified body won't want to ever rest. But as far as I can tell, rest was a part of the original creation. So when do I sleep? And the moon was a part of the original creation, and day and night was as well. So I'm not sure that really what's being said here is there's no nighttime in any place in the new creation. But once you go to the city, the lights never stop shining in the New Jerusalem. You won't ever see the lights go out there. You still may rest, but it's going to be like Alaska part of the year, where there's no moon. It's just sunlight all day, all the time, only better. With these thoughts, the curtains begin to close on John's visions. The remainder of this book is simply going to be an epilogue or a conclusion with random and miscellaneous announcements and comments being made by three different characters: God the Father, Jesus the Lamb, and John himself. In the next two Wednesday nights, we'll go through this in two different lessons and see what God the Father, Jesus the Lamb, and John have to say in their final announcements and comments as they close out this book. But let's finish with one final takeaway. The end will be like the beginning, only better. In The Hobbit, Bilbo's adventures begin and end in the Shire. This charming and cheerful, delightful place on Middle Earth in this fictional story exudes a warm and vibrant sense of comfort and friendliness, happiness, food, and good times, safety. The adventures that happen between the beginning and the end of this story called The Hobbit, well, that's another story. They're anything but comforting and safe, but it sure is nice to know that no matter what adventures, what frightening and horrible, dreadful dangers confront Bilbo Baggins in the middle chapters, he's going to end up right where he started, by the cozy fire in his hobbit hole in the Shire, feeling more safe and cozy than ever before. The overarching storyline of the Bible and human history is this way, only better. It begins in the garden with God, and it ends in a garden with God. Only that garden is bigger and better than before. It makes my little 12x3 strawberry patch that I had in Milwaukee years ago, it makes this life in the Garden of Eden look like that. compared to something like Beauchurch Botanical Gardens, some massive gardens in the world. This is a better place, a better garden. The adventures that happen in between are, for us, and certainly in history, harrowing and horrible, dangerous and even deadly. But there is great comfort in knowing that we're all, who are God's people, going to end up where it started, in the garden with God. The river comes back, it's better. The tree of life comes back in a forest. The work that God has given us to do, we will get back to it and never stop. There will be no curse, it will be reversed. But most importantly, there will be, well, God. God the Father will be immediately and personally with us, and so will be the Lamb. And he will be with us in all his glory. We will enjoy his presence and carry out his plans forever. And this is important. I think this is very important, because a lot of times we read a book like Revelation and we forget as soon as we read that this isn't us floating around in Ethereum somewhere with echoes of prismatic sounds in nothingness, looking at a glowing God and singing songs forever with wings flapping behind our robes. That is not what we are preparing for. We are getting ready for a real physical, material earth, a real city as grand and humongous and majestic as we've read, a real presence of God, a real river gushing from the throne, and real forests of the tree of life with repeated seasons of fruits. And a world to explore and a solar system to explore. We are literally going to that kind of a place, a tactile, material, physical place. That is a part of God's original glorious creation. Yes, God and the Lamb are the center, and by infinite comparison, the most important attraction that's there. But you cannot enjoy God without enjoying his great creation. And he will insist that it is so. In fact, we'll see later on in Revelation 22, he reminds us, drink freely. That is his desire. And so, we have so much to look forward to. And as we look forward, we should see and savor what John saw and let that inspire us to persevere through the twists and the turns and the harrowing adventures of this dark wood. The end of our story, as God's people, is worth the adventure.